Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's a little bit windy today, so I hope this doesn't disturb the recording too much. In our last podcast, Pete read out an excerpt from one of his many writings about teaching yoga. It was called The Myth of the Yoga Teacher, that particular podcast. And he was talking about various kinds of teaching, ones which seem, and I'm being polite there, they are terrible. And he called them parrots, missionaries, and teachers who indulge in domination for their pleasure. But he also mentioned a different kind of teacher, which he calls the sage, which could be a man or a woman. And he recited the line, "These teachers will tell you that they have nothing to teach, who have no desire to hypnotize, convert, or enslave you, who will meet you in openness if you can." And this was the teaching style that Pete was expressing, that was his preference.
Yes.
But we have people coming to our classes 4 times a week, so I was just going to get Pete to describe to me, you know, what he actually does in those classes. Yeah. If there's nothing to teach, what does he do?
Yeah, it seems inconsistent, doesn't it? and it kind of is, you know. There's a sort of a pragmatics that has to emerge out of a kind of ridiculous stance that I'm taking here, you know, that I have nothing to teach. But I will meet you in openness if you can. Well, let me tell you that I suppose that when it comes to the practicality of people wanting to come through the door, and they do keep coming through the door, some of them have been coming through the door for 20 years.
I know, yeah.
You know, well, I suppose that proves I really am a crap teacher. Because if they still need me after 20 years, what's going on? Am I creating dependency? I mean, I don't think so. I think it's very simple. People like it. You know. Because it feels great, so that's cool with me, you know, because I'm not pushing anything. They don't have to buy into anything, they don't have into any system of thought, they don't have to
believe anything.
No, I don't care what they believe, you know, it's all ridiculous. You know, so I take the piss out of people pretty evenly, really, you know. I don't have any preference here, what I feel like having a laugh about, so. Yeah, I'm a very rude fellow, really. But yeah, I mean, there is a technical term for this kind of approach, believe it or not, you know, because there isn't very much that's new under the sun. And it's called anapaya. You probably know the word apaya, which is the word that the Buddhists use to denote skillful means, for ways of teaching that are not dogmatic, but which skillfully help people to catch a glimpse of their already present but slightly repressed blessings and gifts. In other words, the yoga being state. So anapaya means without means. And what it actually means is very, very minimal means. Because even having no method, like somebody like Krishnamurti, is a method. No method is a method, you know. There's a sense at which once there's some kind of meeting in openness, there's some stuff can happen that looks like method. But it seems to me that meeting in openness is just very, very pregnant, just in its own right. I mean, any two people can meet in openness, and it's incredibly pregnant for the being state to be revealed. So this is foremost in my mind, really, I think, in class, as we call it. And I do some stuff with people. For instance, the structure of my class is usually, even though I am a spontaneous teacher, I don't have lesson plans, the structure of my class is usually to start with some sitting meditation for half an hour or something of that order. But very simple, you know, when sitting, just sit. Yeah. Or sitting quietly doing nothing, the grass grows by itself. Straightforward, let's just see what it's like to sit. Quiet, together. Yeah, that together part's quite important. because that's, we can all be in open this together. We've got like this massively electric situation being generated, which is full of possibilities just in its own right. It's like fertile soil.
Yeah.
You know. And there is a little tiny bit of technicality there, which comes down to being able to sit comfortably for half an hour. And I never force anybody or encourage anybody into any kind of endurance test. I'm quite happy for people to stretch their legs out, lean on the wall, lie down if necessary. So I can work with a lot of people like that. They don't have to be just fit enough to sit still for half an hour, cross-legged. Because, you know, if you've already got it, what's the point in striving to achieve X, Y, and Z? That would be cultivation. And cultivation is always according to somebody's ideal of what the aim of that cultivation is to be. And so it's always a second-hand notion, you know. And even if you make your own notion up, where do your ideas come from? You know, they come from your upbringing and your education and your enculturation and so on. So not cultivation, but a little bit of technicality. But my thing is you dispose of the technicality really quickly. That's why I keep everything I do simple. Because if you, as a practitioner, are bogged down in applying the technique that you've been given, you are actually being quite noisy internally. The application of technique is noise. And we're hoping, in as much as we do hope, in this hopeless situation, for some silence to take place, for some settling into quietness to take place. Technique is noise, so get it out the way quickly, so you can directly experience the field and the flow and the unfolding of your own experience. Because that's where it is, that's where the being state is. It's in the unfolding of your own experience, whatever that happens to be. And that includes being in the midst of suffering just as much as it includes being in the Shangri-La ashram up there in the Himalayas in your nice white robes. So that's the first bit, and as I say, it's a being in openness, because there's a little bit of technicality, but we dispose of it really quickly. And once people have got angry, they don't say that much more about it. In fact, I can teach a yoga class without saying anything. And incidentally, without even opening my eyes, which apparently alarmed somebody on the British Wheeler yoga website, saying how disgusting it was that the teacher never opened their eyes.
Yeah, and I tell you what, they'd find this even more disgusting. Once, I had a really good group, and most of them did the whole class with their eyes closed anyway. So I actually blindfolded them all. For the whole class.
You're a disgrace.
Yeah. I know.
You're a disgrace.
And
I'm reporting you.
It was great, actually. It was really great.
I'm going to report you to the yoga place.
Now and again, I had to, because they'd sort of stray off their mats, because obviously they couldn't see. So I'd say, just now and again, everyone bend down and just touch your mat to find out where it is. And then stand back up again and we'd carry on. But it was a great class, actually.
Yeah. You did have to have the ambulance waiting outside, of course, because of all the fractures and and people needing this.
Yeah, they were all perfectly fine.
People needing.
Had a wonderful time.
People needing taxi into the lunatic asylum.
Yeah, well, they were, yeah, apart from that, yeah.
You're a disgrace. I'm reporting you to the yoga place. Anyway, what I do next is I do some simple hatha yoga postures, which everybody would recognise, Somebody coming from other ways of approaching this and poking their head round the door would say, oh yeah, I recognise this. But actually, by keeping the posture simple, technique is disposable very quickly. So, we're not there spending the whole session making internal noise, wrestling with techniques to do very difficult things and to achieve things and to cultivate ourselves according to some desideratum, which is completely and totally second-hand and arbitrary and possibly stupid as well. So once we've got the technique sorted, and again, it's the same thing as I said about sitting. You know, people think, oh, there's yoga and meditation. No, there isn't. It's yoga.
Yeah.
You know.
That's why this thing about hatha yoga is different to meditation is just ridiculous.
Well, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika has got four chapters, and the last one is totally given over to samadhi. You know, which you might loosely describe as the pinnacle of meditation.
Yeah.
So with the standard Hatha Yoga postures, we keep it simple, technically very easy, so that one is very quickly able to be receptive and open to all the sensations that are happening to one, and all the experiences, the emotions, the thoughts, whatever is happening in the field of awareness. We're with it. We're into it. It's not witness consciousness, incidentally, which is rather cold. It's a bit like the hippie thing of being into something, you know. We are ourselves the stream and flow and the dynamic of our unfolding experience. That's what we are, and we're with it in an integrated way, just by allowing ourselves to be receptive and quiet, allowing quietness to come. All right. But also there is the presence of the others in the room. You know, we are meeting each other in our openness in that session. It's very subtle, but it's very kind of real and very powerful.
Yeah, and sometimes not so subtle. Sometimes, it can be palpable in the air.
Yeah, it can be very, very powerful, and it comes out of that mutual openness. This is the time, the place, and the people thing. You know, you can do a lot on your own with yoga, but if you have a group that you can be with, I'm not going to say work with, that you can be with. Who've got a bit of a handle on this receptivity and openness. It's phenomenally powerful. I don't think it's magic like kind of Shaktipat stuff like that. It's to do with mirror neurons. Possibly there's some kind of communication happening through smells, you know, through very subtle smells and pheromones and blah blah blah. Who knows? But I don't think that we need a kind of a magical explanation of that, but it's pretty damn powerful.
So you start off with about 20 minutes, half an hour.
At least half an hour usually. You know, and then move on to doing some simple Hatha yoga postures in pretty well the same fashion as we do the sitting. Get the technique sorted quickly, keep it simple so that's not a great big palaver, and quickly settle into being with the flow of our experience as we are moving the body into various positions and holding it static for a little while. Simply, like it, you know, we sit with awareness, we move with awareness, and then the third part, we lie down, corpse posture, 20 minutes. Again, lie down with awareness. What is it to lie down? And to allow all the muscles to relax because the floor is taking the strain and the muscles needn't work. So we can then let the muscles relax. What happens then? Let's experience that. Now, I mean, technically, every moment of life is an opportunity for the being state to emerge. But practically, some moments in life work a bit better than others. This is just a practical fact of life. You know, this is where the pragmatics intrude, and this is why we do something. Yeah, well, people come to class, and of course we're moving about, certainly in the middle part of our sessions. There's movement, there's doing stuff. If there's somebody new there, there's me actually saying, well, put your foot like this, you know, and let your breath do its thing in this nice soft way. So I'll say some things. And, well, what's all about? Well, that's kind of gives us something to do, you know, whilst we're together.
Yeah, well, it changes the element of the meditation, doesn't
The
feeling of the meditation.
Yeah. And I think these sessions provide opportunities for people to catch a glimpse of their intrinsic beatitude or the yoga being state which they already have and depend on for their very existence. And you know, as I said, not all moments are equal until they are. I mean, once you get thoroughly ensconced in this stuff, every molecule of human passion is grist to your mill. Every single one. Yeah. But the pragmatic reality is that we need to be pointing the yoga beatitude, the yoga being state out to people by encouraging some of those more potent moments for people. And that's what a yoga class is. A yoga class actually is an excuse for us to be together. It's not a class at all, because there's very little information takes place. Certainly not educational in any normal sense of the word. It's simply a being together in openness with some means to encourage that and excuse that. And for the whole situation to do the pointing. Actually, it's not me that points, it's the situation that we create that does the pointing. That being together in the class, inverted commas. So that's what I do. I think I'm pretty good at it.
So we've done the sitting and we've done some moving.
We've waved our arms a bit.
We've waved around and we've done some breathing, and now we've come to the end.
Well, they usually sit again at the end, to be honest with you, but not for very long.
Well, we do the corpse posture and then a little bit of sitting at the end.
Yeah, maybe a minute. And then hit the bell, which is my one little bit of ornamentation. I hit the Tibetan bowl and it makes a nice sound. And I tell them to be careful out there in the big bad world, and they go off.
So my last question, I'd just like to know just how you arrived at this format. So was it through your own practice, or the way that you were taught, or how did you do it differently at the beginning and then it evolved into what it is now?
Well, it's certainly evolved over the years, and it's gone in the direction of more and more simplicity. Pretty well everything I do arises out of my practice, which by now is of some decades,
yeah,
of length, you know. So everything comes out of that, really. Everything comes out of that. And certainly I recognise now that the way that I was infected with yoga was through a meeting in openness with somebody who was also willing to meet in openness, and who was just, three decades ahead of me in practice.
Yeah.
So it creates a sort of a potential difference. And just putting it poetically, there's a kind of a spark, which could be quite dramatic, you know.
Yeah.
And then you catch a glimpse of your blessings, and then you decide either to repress it, which some people do, or to run with it. As I say, that is just a beginning, you know. It's a beginning.
Yeah.
There's no end. There's a beginning, but no end. And then the whole of one's life then is this exploration and inquiry and unfolding of a world of wonder, even in the midst of the tragic character of human life. So yeah, you know, this approach comes out of, well, the way it happened to me, and then what I did with it, and then how I have interacted with probably thousands of people now over the decades I've been teaching. And it's come to, I don't know, a few rules of thumb. Well, there's nothing to teach, really. It's not informational, it's not educational. It's about sharing. It's about a group of people being in openness together. And with some kind of very simple and technically minimal means for us all to point out for each other what it is that we have and how great that is.
Okay, we're back at the house now. And I wanted to ask why he does the stages of the class in this particular order that he does them in. So beginning with sitting meditation, and then the physical aspect, moving around, and then a corpse posture, and then some more sitting at the end. So
yeah.
I just wanted curious, yeah, as to why that particular order.
I start with sitting because I like to use the restless energy that people bring in from their daily lives. And when you sit and allow that restless energy to settle, what happens is it does actually devolve back into its root form, which is just pure life energy. So that sitting part enables us to contact our life energy and allow it to flow. And the actual agitation of having had a normal day in 21st century Britain is very useful for that. You know, we don't have to arouse any energy. We've got plenty of energy to start with, even though it's got this kind of rough character to it, and which we allow to smooth out. And I mean, that smoothing out of energy is a kind of a going back to a more primordial form. And it's just life energy. So you sit to contact life energy.
Yeah.
And then you move, because that life energy now wants to express itself in movement. It wants to flow out through the body.
Mm.
And what that does, it opens the body. Yeah? It opens the body and lets life in. And maybe, on some occasions, lets crap out. So I was like, open the body, let the life in, let the crap out. And it takes any, you know, that comes about through energy expressing itself through movement of the body and through the expansion of yoga postures. So when it comes to adopting corpse posture, the body is open. It's sensitive. It's letting life in. Energy is flowing. So now that's the perfect occasion for experiencing something really spacious and marvellous. Because in the corpse posture, all the technical aspect of the yoga is quite quickly disposed of, because the floor is doing the work in corpse posture. It's supporting the body. So the muscles can turn off.
Yeah.
They don't need to. No muscles are needed to maintain the posture, unlike other yoga postures. So the muscles turn off. And of course, tension in muscles, activity in muscles, sends signals to the brain. And it tells the brain where the body is in space and time. Particularly in space. It gives it a sense of its orientation in space. And that is, of course, also a sense of boundary. The muscles turn off, no signals to the brain, no sense of position of the body in space, and no sense of boundary. Just you know, quite an easy materialist physiological explanation of that. But remember, the body's open. It's open. Life is flowing. Life energy has been contacted. It's expressed itself. That expression of itself has opened the body up further. And of course, body, I say body, I mean body-mind complex, really, you know.
Yeah.
Body-mind, not separate. So then the experience of a wonderful, spacious boundlessness is possible. And this is a very great good.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of rationale. And then, of course, at the end we sit again. And of course, as you sit up, you come back into the ordinary, you know, the ordinary, and even though it's extraordinary. And I like that last little sit, to be there, just to appreciate that. And I call it, you know, tasting the sweetness of the moment. That's what that is for, just that 1 minute there at the end. You really are able then to just simply taste that sweetness.
Yeah. And I'd like to say something about the sitting at the beginning as well. I found that if a class came in, especially if they're a bit agitated, as you say, because of the day and all, you know, everything that's been going on, if they spend some time sitting quietly and connecting with themselves and becoming aware of their body and their breath. This is back when the yoga that we used to do was quite a lot more physical than it is now.
Before we got old,
yeah. It meant that people were far less likely to injure themselves, because if they're just running through the door after having 27,000 meetings at work and looking after 100 children when they got back and cooking dinner and everything and then rush to class, they bring all that busyness into coming and doing the yoga postures and that's when they'd be more likely to hurt themselves because they just carry on. So the sitting just allows everything to slow down, be aware of your body before you start doing any physical work. And then at the end, I quite like this sitting at the end, because I think it gives people a contrast between how they felt at the beginning when they were sitting and how they felt at the end.
Yeah.
So they could see the difference.
Yeah, it's quite valuable.
Yeah. Okay, so I hope you found that useful. If you would like to sample Pete's teachings for yourselves, then we are doing a number of yoga weekends, and the first one is going to be on the 22nd and 23rd of October 2016, so that's coming up quite soon. So
I hope that was interesting, and we'll speak to you soon.